realized that Sandro kissed differently from Marco, more slowly and perhaps less expertly. But when she kissed Sandro back, she could feel what he was thinking, as if the two of them were communicating, having a conversation without speech. Elisabetta loved the feeling, understanding that all kisses weren't the same, but each one unique to the man. And she could feel Sandro answering her question in his kiss, affirming that he had fallen in love with her, and the notion filled her with happiness, just as it had with Marco, who had told her above Piazza Navona. Elisabetta didn't know if she loved Sandro, Marco, or both. So she let herself feel what she was feeling, hoping that someday her heart would tell her its secret. Until then, there was kissing.
Chapter 24. Marco. March 1938. Marco passed under the bower over Elisabetta's front door and entered the entrance hall of her house. She had said she would be home, so he thought he would drop by and surprise her with a bouquet of roses. He knocked on the door to her apartment, which was opened by her father. Ludovico d'Orfeo blinked sleepily, as if he had just been awakened, naked to the waist in droopy pants. His hair was greasy, and his beard untrimmed. Marco had never seen much of him, though he had always suspected the man had a drinking problem. Marco! Her father glowered at him, unsteady on his feet. What do you want?
Buonasera, Signor D'Orfeo. Excuse me for disturbing.
Flowers? What for?
Marco could smell the wine wafting off the man. Therefore, Elisabetta. Is she?
No! She's not here.
Her father exploded, enraged. He snatched the bouquet from Marco and threw the flowers to the floor, where some broke, their petals scattering.
Signor D'Orfeo, what are you doing?
Are you fucking my daughter?
Sir, no.
Marco recoiled, shocked.
Don't lie to me. Are you?
No, I swear to you.
Then why bring her flowers?
I love her.
No.
Her father shouted, practically spitting.
You do not love Elisabetta. You may not love her. I will not allow it, never.
Why do you say this, sir?
Marco had no idea why the man didn't like him.
I assure you, my intentions are honorable.
Don't talk to me about honor. Terrizzis have no honor. Your father fucked my wife. Did you know that?
Marco gasped. It was impossible, as his parents barely knew Elisabetta's. He had no idea why her father would say such an awful thing.
Yes, believe it. Your father fucked my wife. Everybody knows it but you and my daughter. The great Beppe Terizzi is not the honest man he pretends to be. I may be a drunk, but I'm an honest man, not a scoundrel.
That's not possible, Marco stammered, hushed.
Oh, yes, it is. Your father. He ruined my wife. She was never the same. She took one lover after the next. It was the beginning of the end for me, for my family.
Marco edged away. My father would never be unfaithful to my mother.
Terizzi's ruined my wife, but you will not ruin my daughter. Get out of my house. Go! Don't you dare tell Elisabetta, or I'll throttle you with my own hands.
Her father showed his gnarled hands to Marco.
They still work, don't doubt it. Never see her again.
Marco turned and flew out the door.
Part 2. Rome is the city of echoes, the city of illusions, and the city of longing. Giotto di Bondone. Rome is our point of departure and reference. It is our symbol, or if you wish, our myth. We dream of a Roman Italy, that is to say wise, strong, disciplined, and imperial. Much of that which was the immortal spirit of Rome rises again in fascism. The fasces are Roman. Our organization of combat is Roman. Our pride and our courage is Roman.
Civis Romanus sum. Benito Mussolini, April 22, 1922. Opera Omnia 18, 160-161.
Chapter 25. Marco, March 1938. Marco pedaled away from Elisabetta's house in a frenzy. Sweat poured from his body, and he accelerated past cars as if he had taken leave of his senses. It couldn't be true that his father had been unfaithful with Elisabetta's mother. Marco was riding north to the Borgo district, just outside the Vatican walls, where his brother Emedio lived. The oldest son, Emedio had always been his mother's confidant, having the most mature and responsible temperament of the Terizzi boys. They all thought that he had been born a priest, rather than called to it in later life, and Marco was betting that Emedio would know the truth. His mind reeled, frantic for explanations. What Elisabetta's father had said must have been a drunkard's ravings. Delusions afflicted men who drank, Marco knew from the regulars at the bar. They consumed glass after glass, even in the morning, sometimes ordering two at a time. It had to be that Elisabetta's father had an addled, wine-soaked brain, because Marco knew that his father was an honest man, a moral man, and his hero. He admired his father for so many reasons, for becoming one of the best cyclists in the country, serving so bravely on the Isonzo front, making a success of himself, and providing a business for their entire family. Marco's legs churned at top speed, and his thoughts raced. He knew that his parents had a loving relationship. He had seen as much. He would catch them stealing kisses, or see his father squeeze his mother's bottom. He could feel the earthy heat between them, and he even heard them at night, making love. They worked as partners, his father in front of the bar and his mother in the kitchen, supporting each other in every way. He had always thought that theirs was the kind of marriage he would have with Elisabetta. Marco sped into Emedio's neighborhood, which was lined with well-maintained houses and leafy trees. Priests in black cassocks and nuns in black or blue habits walked in groups along the pavement, for the district attracted Vatican employees and clergy. Twilight fell softly, bringing with it a quiet peace, though Marco felt anything but. He zoomed down Via Bonifacio the Eighth, and saw that the lights were on in Emedio's front window. He tore through the intersection to Emedio's apartment, where he jumped off his bike and hollered at the window. In the next moment, his brother stuck his head out, leaning on the sill with a smile.
"I'll be right down," Emedio called down. "I was just going out."
"Hurry!" Marco tried to compose himself, but it was impossible. And as soon as Emedio appeared in the front door, he launched into a feverish account of the story, telling every detail before they'd even moved from the doorstep. Emedio listened, his expression typically attentive, and when Marco was finished, he looked directly into his brother's large, dark eyes, which were so much like their father's.
"Emedio, it can't be true, can it?"
"Brother, you need to calm down.
You have to tell me it's not true."
"Relax." Emedio tried to place his hands on Marco's arms, but Marco broke his grasp.
"Emedio,
let's walk and talk then. I need cigarettes, and I'd rather my neighbors not hear more than they already have." Emedio started walking,
and Marco fell in step beside him, rolling his bicycle at his side.
Well?
It's true. Marco felt it as a blow to the chest. He stopped in his tracks.
I don't believe it. How do you know?
Mamma told me. Marco felt a wave of sympathy for his mother.
How did she find out?
She caught them in bed.
No!
Marco gasped, appalled. He had so many questions.
When did this happen? How did they even know each other?
Let's walk, Marco. Emedio resumed walking, his head down and his hands clasped behind his back. The hem of his black cassock popped forward with every footstep. It happened when you were a baby, but I don't know more. She didn't want to talk about it, and I didn't want to press her.
I can't believe this.
Marco raked his hand through his hair. He walked beside his brother, but had never felt so alone.
Does Papa know that you know?
No, and we've never spoken of it. I've gone from being his son to his moral compass. She told me years ago, saying they had both put it behind them.
Does Aldo know?
No, and don't tell him. Mamma wants it that way. It's in the past.
Why didn't you tell me?
For the same reason. And I knew you would have an emotional reaction. Marco boiled over.
It's normal, don't you think?
Yes, but it's unpredictable. Anyway, you were younger then.
But Papa sets himself above us. He acts as if he's perfect, without faults.
And now you know better. So you have to accept that. Emedio looked over, his eyes frank. You're not naive. You know that married men stray.
But not our father, cheating on our mother.
Marco shook his fist.
I should tell him I know. I should throw it in his face.
Please don't. Emedio grimaced as they walked under a tree. You'll only hurt Mamma. Let it lie. Marco sensed that Emedio was right.
But how could Mamma get over such a thing? Why did she forgive him?
Her faith.
Is faith the answer to everything?
Marco shot back reflexively. Yes, exactly, Emedio answered, amused. What have I devoted my life to? Faith is the answer to everything. Faith in God, in love, in forgiveness.
Basta!
Marco threw up his hand.
Why don't you feel angry on her behalf? Father Terizzi, is there no limit for a father who pretends to be a wonderful family man? Who pretends to be a good fascist? Who reveres law and order?
Our father is in heaven. My mortal father runs a bar. He's a human being who makes mistakes. And fascism is no guarantee of moral rectitude. On the contrary.
Oh, that's right, Marco fumed. I forgot you hate us now.
I don't hate anybody. Emedio turned onto Via di Porta Cavalleggeri, a main thoroughfare lined with offices and shops. Mussolini may think war is strength, but I know different. Every Christian does. He gestured at St. Peter's Basilica.
Look, isn't that the most beautiful sight?
Marco looked up at the lighted dome of St. Peter's, emanating a warm ivory glow against a darkening sky, under a moon as white and round as a communion wafer. On any other night, he would have found the sight comforting. But not tonight. Tonight, nothing helped. Marco, I worship the Prince of Peace, so I'm no fascist.
And I worship the Prince of War?
Let's not discuss politics when I need a cigarette. Emedio pursed his lips. So what about Elisabetta?
What about her? She doesn't know about Papa and her mother, and I'm not going to tell her if that's what you mean.
That's not what I meant. I meant, you're not going to keep seeing her, are you?
Yes.
Emilio stopped. You can't, Marco. You can be friends with her, but no more. Marco stopped too.
But I love her.
Emilio frowned. Can you imagine Elisabetta at our table for Sunday lunch? How do you think Mamma would feel? Serving the daughter of her husband's mistress. Think of Papa, too.
Mamma says Elisabetta reminds him of her mother.
It's not tenable.
Papa deserves what he gets.
Marco's gut wrenched.
I love her, and we've been friends forever.
But now that you know the truth, you can't be together.
I can't give her up.
Marco knew it was true, even though he understood Emilio's objection.
And why did they let us be friends anyway? Why allow it?
You were classmates, and it couldn't be helped. They thought if they intervened, you'd only want each other more. Emilio's tone softened. Look, you're young. You can have any girl you want. You can't tell me she matters that much to you.
She does.
How far has it gone?
You ask me that, brother?
Marco felt offended.
It hasn't gone that far.
You? Wait for a woman? Emilio lifted a dark eyebrow. I don't believe you. Marco's mood worsened.
I have every right to be with Elisabetta.
It's not about what you can do, but what you should do. Give her up.
I won't. You know Sandra wants her too. You can root against me. Does that make you feel better?
Emilio's forehead eased. Let Sandro have her. He'd be good for her.
I'd be good for her. Why do you think I'm not?
Marco stiffened.
You still see me as your baby brother, but you need to take another look. I work for the party now, and they respect me. I know all the top people at Palazzo Braschi. I'm moving up.
Emilio pursed his lips. Forgive me if I don't salute.
Watch your step now.
Marco regretted the words as soon as they had left his lips. Emilio frowned. That was your dark side talking.
I don't have a dark side.
Everybody does. You're losing God's voice, working at the fascio. Marco didn't want to hear any more. He began rolling his bicycle away.
Goodbye.
Marco, wait. But Marco leapt onto his bicycle and pedaled off. He picked up speed, not caring where he was going. Everything he had known about his family was false. His world had been shattered, and he didn't know whom to believe in, if he couldn't believe in his father. Chapter 26. Sandro. April 1938. Sandro opened the door to find his family getting ready for their Seder, as it was the first night of Passover. He had come from La Sapienza with wonderful news, happy to be able to share it on a special night with Rosa home. The dining room table was set with their best linens, china, glasses, and silver, and his mother was positioning a vase of flowers as a centerpiece. A Vivaldi violin concerto played softly on the radio.
Happy Passover, Sandro, said his father as he straightened his tie in the mirror.
Rosa and David also greeted him, setting wine on the sideboard.
Happy Passover, everybody.
Sandro hung his backpack on the coat rack, then kissed his father and sister, who was dressed up in a suit of dark blue that set off the glossy russet of her hair. She had on makeup and floral perfume, but she'd been wearing more of.
You smell better than usual, Sandro said, teasing her.
You smell worse,
Rosa shot back with a smile. Sandro, good to see you. David shook his hand, and Sandro liked him, though his brown tweed suit was more stuffy than any Roman would wear, especially in the springtime. Sandro's mother embraced him, dressed up in a gray suit with her pearl necklace and pearl drop earrings, and her hair was swept into its chic silvery twist. Cornelia entered the dining room carrying a silver platter of harosit, a puree of dates, raisins, oranges, and figs, the traditional start to the Passover meal, served to represent the bricks and mortar used by Jewish slaves.
That looks delicious, Cornelia.
Cornelia received his compliment with a nod.
We're having vegetable and lamb lasagna and pesce in carpione the way you like.
Wonderful. Everybody gather around now. I have something to show you.
Sandro extracted the envelope from his jacket pocket, flushed with happiness.
It's a letter from Professor Levi Civita. I wrote to him and he responded. Look.
Let's see that.
His father hurried over, and his mother, sister, David, and Cornelia clustered around him. Sandro read the letter aloud.
Dear Alessandro, thank you for your note. I have seen your work, and it is superb. You show great promise for the future of Italian mathematics. I would like to offer you a job reporting directly to me upon your graduation from liceo. I hope to meet you as soon as my schedule allows, and I shall remain in touch. Best regards, Levi Civita.
His father patted Sandro's back. Congratulations! How exciting, son! You're on your way!
How wonderful!
His mother clasped her hands together in delight.
I'm so proud of you, Sandro. I told you!
Brilliant,
David said, smiling.
Bravissimo!
Cornelia beamed. Rosa snorted.
But do we have to call you Mr. Future of Italian Mathematics now?
Ha!
Sandro grinned, returning the letter to his breast pocket. Try Doctor Future of Italian Mathematics. They all laughed, especially his mother.
Sandro, she said, your father's new clients, the Ferraras, are coming tonight. Do you mind if we tell them about your job offer?
Can anybody stop you?
Sandro answered, and they all laughed again.
The Ferraras will be so impressed. They're bringing their daughter, Rachele. She's your age and an excellent student, so you have that in common.
Son, I've seen her picture.
His father winked behind his glasses.
She's a real beauty.
Sandro realized that his parents were playing matchmaker. He hated to disappoint them, but he couldn't go along.
Mamma, papa, I don't want to meet a girl.
Don't be shy, his mother said with an encouraging smile. You're old enough and very eligible, with a brilliant future ahead of you.
His father nodded.
She's right, Sandro. We never wanted your abilities, as prodigious as they are, to prevent you from having a normal life. You work hard, but it's time to socialize with the opposite sex. You're entitled to a family someday.
Sandro hesitated. But I'm already seeing someone. Elisabetta. His father frowned.
D'Orfeo?
His mother blinked.
But she's an old friend. We mean a girl you could be interested in romantically.
His father nodded.
Rachele's father has a ceramic factory that's doing quite well. They live in the suburbs, and they're a lovely family.
Sandro felt his chest tighten. He wanted to please his parents, but this time he couldn't.
I'm sorry, but I'm not interested in anyone except Elisabetta.
His mother's smile began to fade.
When did this come to pass?
Sandro, we had no idea,
his father added, disconcerted.
I always thought you and Elisabetta were just friends.
We've grown into more. My feelings for her...
But she's not Jewish.
his father interrupted, matter-of-factly.
Right?
His mother nodded, her pearl earrings swinging.
Sandro, you can't become serious with a Gentile girl.
Why can't I? Sandro asked, causing an immediate reaction. His father recoiled, and his mother pursed her lips. Rosa remained silent, and David looked down. The holiday mood vanished, and Cornelia fled to the kitchen. Vivaldi's violins continued to play, soothing no one.
Sandro, this can't be.
His father's eyebrows sloped unhappily downward.
Judaism is important to us. You were properly raised in our faith. You feel the same way, don't you?
Sandro hadn't given Elisabetta's religion much thought until this moment. He had been focused on trying to win her heart.
Well, of course my Jewishness is important to me. Then why weren't you looking for a Jewish girl?
His mother interjected, frowning.
I wasn't looking for any girl at all. What happened was that one day, actually, it happened on the day that I got the internship with Levi Civita, I was with Elisabetta at the river, and it dawned on me that I had feelings for her. I knew, because when I got the good news about the professor, she was the one I wanted to tell, after I told you, Mamma.
His mother's frown remained in place.
But can't you have feelings for a Jewish girl?
I suppose so. But that's not what happened. It doesn't matter to me whether Elisabetta is Gentile or Jewish. She's Elisabetta, and that's all that matters. The rest will sort itself.
When?
His father shot back.
How?
His mother added.
I don't know,
Sandro answered, pained. All I know is that I've fallen in love with her.
You what?
His father's eyes flared.
You do?
His mother gasped.
You love her?
You can't. Rosa intervened, touching their father's arm.
Papa, there's no reason to make an issue of this now. It's not as if Sandro's going to marry the first girl he's serious about.
I disagree,
his father snapped.
You know Sandro. He's a serious young man. How many girls do you think he'll court before he settles down?
His mother lifted an eyebrow.
Rosa, did you not hear what your brother just said? What if he marries Elisabetta?
Sandro was grateful for Rosa's attempt to help, but it only worsened matters. The talk of marriage was getting ahead of him, but he couldn't say that he didn't want to marry Elisabetta. His father faced him.
Son, if you marry Elisabetta, your children won't be Jewish unless she converts. Is she willing to convert?
Sandro's mouth went dry.
I don't know. We haven't discussed it yet, and
your children must be Jewish. Your mother and I want Jewish grandchildren. You know how important our lineage is, too. Our family has history here. We are history here.
Rosa turned to their father.
But, Papa, Elisabetta's a lovely girl, and plenty of Jews intermarry. You made that point the first time we had dinner with David, remember?
His father recoiled.
I was speaking in the abstract, not with respect to my own son.
Sandro felt bewildered. His father was always so rational. But this didn't stand to reason. Why should the result be different? It shouldn't turn on whether it's me.
We Jews shouldn't intermarry more often than we do. Our numbers are small enough.
His father pursed his lips.
Son, we forbid you to see Elisabetta.
His mother straightened.
Your father's right. You can be friends with her, but we won't allow more than that.
Sandro caught Rosa's eye, and they exchanged glances. He wondered if she remembered what he had told her once, that asking permission was inconsistent with adulthood.
Mamma,
Papa, I'm sorry to upset you, but I'll continue to see Elisabetta. Suddenly the sound of chatter came from the stairwell outside the apartment, and they all turned to the door in dismay.
Happy Passover, a voice called out over the sound of knocking. It's the Ferraras.
Chapter 27. Marco. April 1938. Marco sat in the office waiting for the school principal, Preside Livorno. The two older secretaries, Edda and Natalina, sat at their desks, typing so rapidly on their black Olivettis that the keystrokes sounded like a fusillade. The waiting area contained the same old wooden furniture, stacks of files, and cluttered bulletin boards as every other room in school, and the same Italian flags and framed photographs of King Vittorio Emanuele III and Mussolini. Sunlight struggled to make its way through the dirty windows, and the air smelled of cigarette smoke. Marco fidgeted in the smooth wood of the chair. The king, Mussolini, and Preside Livorno put him in mind of his father, whom he had not been able to look in the eye since learning about his infidelity. It left him unhappy and unmoored, tied to nothing and admiring even less. He felt essentially fatherless, leaderless, and try as he might to make sense of the revelation, he couldn't. It didn't help that he couldn't discuss it with anyone, as he was angry at Emedio, forbidden to tell Aldo, and too embarrassed to tell Sandro. The bell rang loudly, signaling the end of the school day. The building erupted with the talking, laughter, and shouting of hundreds of students, so loud that it came through the walls of the office. Marco glanced out the door, which had a window in its upper half, and a horde of students piled into the hallway to leave school. Suddenly he spotted Elisabetta walking down the hallway with Sandro. Marco sat bolt upright, newly impatient. He didn't want to give them a chance to be alone together, as at school he and Sandro were constantly jockeying for their time. Elisabetta had started working in the afternoons, like Marco at the Fascio and Sandro at La Sapienza, so their carefree days at the riverbank were no more. Preside Livorno emerged from his office, holding a cigarette with falling ash.
Marco?
Sir, I'm ready. Let's meet. Marco jumped up, hurried into the office, and sat down in a chair in front of the principal's desk, which was covered with piles of papers, school records, notebooks, and an overflowing ashtray. Behind the desk was a thick shelf that held books and photos of Preside Livorno's family with a brown and white pony. Smoke fogged the air. Preside Livorno closed the door and crushed out his cigarette as he eased into his seat. White hair billowed on either side of his head, and heavy glasses perched atop his hawkish nose, magnifying his dark hooded eyes. He was old and thin, lost in a worn gabardine suit with a tricolor lapel emblem. Preside Livorno, I hope this won't take long. Marco wanted to catch up with Elisabetta and Sandro. I'm late for work.
What work is that?
Preside Livorno asked, his voice raspy. I work after school at the Fascio. I serve as assistant to Commendatore Buonaccorso.
Commendatore whoever will have to wait.
Preside Livorno linked his arthritic hands on top of a thick manila file.
Marco, I have reviewed your academic records, and I am concerned. Your grades have been declining for a long time. The consensus among your teachers is that you have not applied yourself. Your assignments are sloppy and not proofread.
Marco had heard this many times before, and didn't know how many times he could hear it again.
Importantly, many of your teachers have noted that your ability to read lags far behind your class. In reviewing some of your recent assignments, I have doubts about whether, in fact, you can read.
Marco's chest tightened. He felt exposed, caught. His face went hot with shame.
These matters should have been addressed a while ago, but I cannot speak to what happened before my time. I believe previous reports have incorrectly analyzed the problem. In my opinion, there may be some physiological explanation, so I have drafted a letter for you to take home to your parents.
Preside Livorno opened the manila folder, pulled out a piece of paper, and passed it over the desk.
Why do you want me to give that to my parents?
Marco glanced at the letter, but couldn't possibly read it, which made him wonder if it was some sort of test.
It requires their signature. I would like them to consent to your seeing a neurologist for an evaluation.
A neurologist? Marco asked, aghast. He hadn't thought he could feel worse than he already did about school, but evidently that was possible. Isn't that a brain doctor?
Well, yes, in a sense.
There's nothing wrong with my brain. I may not be as smart as the others, but my brain is normal.
You misunderstand me.
Preside Livorno pushed up his heavy glasses, flustered.
I'm not saying there's something wrong with your brain. On the contrary, many of your teachers remark that your memory is excellent, you solve problems effectively, and your wits are quick. The neurologist, I propose, has expertise in a relatively new field, that of educational disabilities.
Just because somebody can't read doesn't mean there's something wrong with his brain.
Marco jumped to his feet, mortified. I can ride faster than anybody I know, but there's nothing wrong with the legs of people who ride slower, is there?
No, that's not what I'm saying.
But it is. On the one hand, I'm quick-witted, but on the other, my brain is disabled. Which is it? How can I solve problems effectively with an abnormal brain?
Marco, sit down, and allow me to explain. I fear that you cannot succeed in school unless you—
No.
Marco slung his backpack over his shoulder.
I do an excellent job at the fascio. I organize the entire filing system for our bills. I handle reports every day. I'm entrusted with confidential communications. I'm the youngest assistant at Palazzo Braschi. No one else from school even has that job. Did you know that?
Marco, I'm sure,
and don't think I didn't notice your attitude toward my boss.
Marco found his emotional footing in anger.
You're lucky I don't tell Commendatore Buonacorso all about you. You betray your government with that disrespectful talk, sir.
Preside Livorno blenched, which emboldened Marco. On the spot, he made a decision.
Keep your letter, sir. Don't dare send it to my parents. They'll find it as insulting as I do. I'm finished with school. I quit.
What?
Preside Livorno's eyes rounded in alarm. Marco headed to the door, just as Preside Livorno rose from his chair.
Son, you don't mean this. Goodbye.
Marco left the office and hurried to the exit. He joined the stragglers leaving school, his heart pounding with adrenaline. He had never been so embarrassed. He thanked God that nobody else had heard what Preside Livorno had said to him. He fleetingly wondered if the secretaries knew, and realized one of them must have typed the letter. Tears came to his eyes, but he blinked them away. He suppressed his emotions and scanned the schoolyard for Elisabetta and Sandro. Sandro's bicycle was gone, and Elisabetta always walked to school, so Marco took a guess that Sandro was walking her to the restaurant. Marco dashed to his bicycle, jumped on, and pedaled from school. He realized it was the last time he would ever do so, and he tried to look on the bright side. He no longer had to worry that Elisabetta, Sandro, or any of his classmates would figure out that he could barely read. He no longer had to develop strategies to pretend. All of the games were over, and he looked forward to the future. He was free. He rode through Trastevere and spotted Elisabetta and Sandro a block ahead, talking in front of the cheese shop. Marco was about to call to them, but a sudden realization stopped him. Now that he had quit school, he would lose the opportunity to see Elisabetta every day. Sandro would automatically gain ground with her. Marco pedaled toward them, his mind racing. Elisabetta! Sandro! Sandro turned with a smile, and so did Elisabetta. She was stunning, in a fresh yellow dress, looking like sunshine itself, standing next to a tall clay pot of pink, white, and yellow snapdragons.
"What kept you with Prese di Livorno?" she asked, tilting her head.
Marco slowed his bike and managed a grin to save face.
"Guess what? I quit school."
"What?" Elisabetta's lovely eyes flared.
"You mean, for good?"
Sandro frowned.
"Are you sure? Why? How did this come about?"
Marco dismounted, his smile in place.
"He summoned me to the office to talk about my work, and I started telling him how much I enjoyed my job. The more I talked about it, the more I started to realize that I liked it better than school."
Elisabetta blinked.
"But that doesn't mean you should quit, does it?"
Sandro nodded. "Right, and we're so close to graduating."
Marco shrugged, but he felt touched.
Elisabetta looked worried about him, and Sandro, his best friend and rival for her affection, was genuinely concerned.
He felt like embracing them,
but had to make light of the matter.
"I know, but I don't want to wait until graduation. Quitting now makes sense for me. I make good money at the fascio, and if I work longer hours, I can make even more. Work is my future, and why shouldn't my future begin today?"
Elisabetta nodded, sympathetic.
"I understand completely. I'm trying to stay until graduation, but that may not work out."
Sandro met his eye.
"But Marco, what will your father say?"
Marco felt anger flame in his chest at his father.
"I'll explain it to him, but honestly, I don't care. I'm growing up, and I have to make my own decisions. Do you understand?"
"Absolutely."
Sandro's expression darkened. "Lately, I've been thinking along the same lines. We can't always do what our parents say. We have to do what we think is right, no matter what they say. We're adults."
Marco felt validated, if surprised, as Sandro never deviated from his parents.
Elisabetta remained silent, and Marco realized she had been an adult for a long time, and that she had to support herself and her drunken father with no mother at all. His heart went out to her, and he loved her all the more.
Sandro checked his watch. "I'm late. I have to get to work."
"Me too,"
Elisabetta nodded.
Marco looked from Elisabetta to Sandro and back again.
Maybe leaving school would help him win her, since he would be able to provide for her sooner than Sandro could. He didn't say so, as he didn't want to hurt Sandro's feelings. It wasn't easy to love the same woman as his best friend. And Marco had a feeling it was only going to get harder.
Chapter 28. Elisabetta, 19th of June, 1938. Elisabetta hustled from the kitchen with a platter of fettuccine alla romana, a pasta with sausage, short ribs, and pomodoro sauce. The tray felt hot on her forearm, but she wasn't allowed to hurry at Il Cacciatore, the fanciest restaurant in Trastevere. She had just started working extra shifts here, since Casa Servano and Nonna had helped her get the job, for which Elisabetta was grateful, as the pay was better and she was able to bring home leftovers for her father and Rico. She crossed the packed dining room, which was served by six other waitresses, a cadre of busboys, and a sommelier. Chatter filled the air, as did the clatter of dishes and silverware, mixing with the aromas of sizzling bracciola, a house specialty. She would make money today, as Italy had just won the World Cup and Rome was celebrating. Il Cacciatore's food was excellent, though overpriced, and its dining room was decorated to perfection, with the finest white tablecloths and centerpieces of fresh sunflowers. Sunshine poured through its large front windows, bordered outside with wisteria that made a beautiful frame. "Here's your pasta, sir. Buon appetito." Elisabetta served a man at a table with his wife and two young sons. "Thank you," he said, nodding. "May I get you anything else?" Elisabetta asked, setting the tray on the sidebar. "No, thank you," the father answered. And Elisabetta checked her station to see if anybody else needed anything. She spotted a party of six being seated at one of her tables by the window, and in the next moment she realized that it was Sandro with his parents and another couple, with a pretty daughter about their age. Sandro was smiling at the girl, his handsome face alive with animation, and the girl was smiling back. Elisabetta's heart sank. He hadn't mentioned anything about the dinner, and he didn't know that she was working here today. It hadn't occurred to her that he would be interested in another girl, but maybe he was. He could have become impatient, waiting for her to decide between him and Marco. But he had said that he loved her, and she had never known him to be anything but true to his word. Elisabetta stalled, loath to serve them. Sandro sat down next to the daughter, chatting her up. She had rich brown eyes, shiny dark hair, and a blue dress with a tailored cut. The families had been celebrating the World Cup victory, dressed up in nice clothes, wearing the blue scarves of the Azzurri. As a group, they looked sophisticated, well-heeled, and respectable. The restaurant manager motioned to Elisabetta, signaling that she serve Sandro's table. She braced herself, took her pad from her apron pocket, and walked over. "Hello. Welcome to Il Cacciatore," Elisabetta said with a professional smile. The Simones were reading their menus, and the father of the other couple, seated at the head of the table, looked up. "Thank you. We're celebrating Italy's victory. It's back-to-back wins for us. What a day for the Azzurri and the Black Shirts, eh?" "Yes, what a day," Elisabetta forced a smile. "May I get you some water? Still or sparkling?" "We'd like a bottle of your finest Prosecco. We are lucky to live in the time of Meazza." "I'll send the sommelier over immediately." Elisabetta glanced at Sandro, whose head was down, reading his menu. Meanwhile, Signor Simone and Dottoressa Simone had recognized her, with unhappily surprised expressions. Signor Simone smiled tightly. "Elisabetta, how nice to see you." Dottoressa Simone smiled equally tightly. "Yes, these are our friends, the Ferraras." Sandro looked up, then burst into a grin. "Elisabetta, I never expected to see you here." "Evidently not," Elisabetta thought. "It's good to see you." Signor Ferrara looked over. "Oh, Sandro, do you know the waitress?" Elisabetta held her breath. She didn't know how Sandro would answer. She wished she could flee to the kitchen. Signor Simone interjected. "Yes, this is Elisabetta d'Orfeo. She's a classmate of Sandro's." Dottoressa Simone nodded. "Elisabetta grew up with Sandro, a childhood friend."
"Mama, Papa, that's not quite correct."
Sandro turned his attention to Signor Ferrara with a sly smile.
"Elisabetta is far more than a childhood playmate. I'm in love with her, and I hope she'll be my girlfriend someday."
Elisabetta laughed, and a surge of happiness raced throughout her body. Sandro was wonderful to stand up for her so publicly when he could easily have let it pass. She met his shining blue eyes with hers, feeling the strength of the bond between them.
Elisabetta, allow me to introduce you, Sandro gestured. You know my parents, and our guests are my father's clients, the Ferraras and their daughter Rachele.
It's very nice to meet you, Elisabetta said to the Ferraras.
Elisabetta, it's very nice to meet you. Signor Ferrara nodded politely.
Yes, very nice, Signora Ferrara added. Ciao, Elisabetta, Rachele smiled sweetly. Ciao, Elisabetta said, sympathetic.
Glad we cleared that up, Sandro winked at her.
The Prosecco is on me, Elisabetta said, in a newly celebratory mood.
Chapter 29. Marco. 14th July, 1938. The morning sun streamed through the stone archway at Palazzo Braschi, and Marco picked up the heavy box and carried it inside the entrance hall, sweating from the effort. His wool uniform tortured him in the heat, and he did all the heavy lifting at work as the youngest and strongest. The bosses were away today, and the guards Giuseppe and Tino were reading the newspaper, their heads bent together and the black tassels of their fezes falling into their faces.
Marco, did you see this article? Giuseppe asked him.
Tino shook his head, reading.
Madonna, this is big news.
What? Marco set the box on a stack by the elevator in a small lobby behind the reception area.
Look.
Giuseppe held up the front page, but Marco averted his eyes as he couldn't read a word. Read it aloud so I can keep working, would you?
Okay. It's a letter called the Manifesto of the Racial Scientists, and it's signed by 42 scientists. In the beginning, it says obvious facts like human races exist. Then in paragraph 6, it says, there exists by now a pure Italian race.
Giuseppe continued reading aloud.
Then it says there is a pure blood kinship that unites today's Italians with the generations that for millennia have populated Italy. This ancient purity of blood is the greatest measure of the Italian nation's nobility.
È vero. Marco picked up another box.
Viva l'Italia!
Tino raised a fist. Giuseppe continued.
The conception of racism in Italy must be essentially Italian and with an Aryan Nordic tendency. This doesn't mean, however, that theories of German racism should be introduced unchanged into Italy.
Tino lifted an eyebrow.
Of course it doesn't. Hitler wishes he could be Duce.
Marco set the box on the stack. He didn't like Hitler, though he kept that to himself, especially since the rally in Piazza Venezia. There had been increasing talk of war at work, but nobody knew if Italy would choose Germany's side or Great Britain's. Despite Hitler's visit to Rome, Italy had signed an agreement with Great Britain in April. Everybody at Palazzo Braschi held his breath to see which way Italy would go. And Marco sensed this country was like Elisabetta, trying to choose between two suitors.
Giuseppe cleared his throat. Here's the big news. The Manifesto of the Racial Scientists says in paragraph 9, Jews do not belong to the Italian race.
What? Marco didn't understand what he was hearing. He stopped hauling boxes.
You must be reading it wrong. Of course Jews belong to the Italian race. They're Italian Jews.
Not anymore.
Tino lifted an eyebrow.
It says so, right here in the manifesto. This must be the position of the party as of today. This manifesto wouldn't have been published without approval of the big bosses at Palazzo Venezia.
But it can't be. Marco recoiled.
Il Duce wouldn't do that. Jews have always been considered Italians.
It's never been any other way.
It's changing, Marco.
Tino shot him a warning look.
That's what Giuseppe is trying to tell you.
Giuseppe frowned over the newspaper.
Hold on. I'm almost finished with the article. It says, the Jews represent the only population that has never assimilated in Italy because it is racially non-European, completely different from the elements that created Italians.
But that's not true. Marco felt stricken. He knew Sandro would be horrified when he read the newspaper.
Jews are no different from us. They were born in Italy. They're Italians and Europeans. My best friend is Jewish.
Marco, enough. Tino lowered his voice. Keep that to yourself from now on. Capisci?
He's right, Marco.
Giuseppe looked up. His lips pursed.
Okay, enough politics.
Marco concealed his emotions out of prudence.
Why don't I go get us some biscotti? I know a great bakery. It's a short ride away. What do you say?
Great idea, Tino answered, nodding. Giuseppe brightened.
I agree.
I'll get my bicycle, Marco said, taking off. Marco rode to see Sandra with a dozen Anisette biscotti in his backpack, having used the errand as an excuse. The ghetto was a quick ride from Palazzo Braschi, and he hoped he could catch Sandra before he left for La Sapienza. He entered the ghetto from the north side, closer to Sandro's house. His tires bumped over the cobblestones as he reached Piazza Mattei, where a group of men stood discussing the manifesto, newspapers in hand. He recognized the elderly Signor Narduno and the Ingegnere Rotoli, who were so upset they barely noticed him. Marco sympathized. It bewildered him to think that with a stroke of a pen, some so-called racial scientists would arbitrarily decide that Italian Jews would no longer be considered Italian. He could only hope that Il Duce would disavow the manifesto in the days to come. He hopped off his bicycle and looked up at Sandro's house, its well-maintained facade an ochre hue, and its shutters the conventional dark green. It was one of the loveliest homes lining this quiet, refined piazza, which was comfortably shady in summer, and at its center stood the elegant Fontana delle Tartarughe, a fountain that had four turtles perched at the top of its white marble bowl. Water gurgled from its spouts, still fed by an ancient Roman aqueduct, the Acqua Vergine, and its cool spray misted the air.
Sandro!
Marco called up to the open window, the way he always did, and Sandro's face popped into view.
I'll be right down.
Marco leaned his bicycle against the wall, and after a few minutes, Sandro emerged from the house, dressed for La Sapienza in a white shirt and tan pants with leather shoes. They greeted each other warmly. Then Marco asked him,
Do you have time to catch up? I sneaked out of work to see you.
Sure. Sandro gestured him to the fountain, and they sat down on the ledge together, another thing they always did.
Here, have some biscotti.
Marco took the box from his backpack and opened it, releasing the fresh scent of baked anise. He handed a biscotto to Sandro.
Did you see the manifesto in the newspaper?
Yes. It's shocking. Insulting. Sandro frowned, pursing his lips.
I'm Italian, no matter what they say.
Of course you are. Marco was about to take a biscotto, but lost his appetite. It hurt him to see Sandro hurting.
There's no valid science behind it. It's not fact-based in the least.
I know, and it doesn't make sense. I can't abide this happening to you and your family, or to anyone in the ghetto. I have to believe it will be discredited.
Sandro exhaled slowly. My father thinks it will. He says it's pure propaganda. But I've been worrying that Mussolini is becoming more like Hitler.
He can't be.
Marco felt disgusted by the very notion. We can't be. My father says the manifesto doesn't address fascist Jews. He sees us as an exception.
But the manifesto didn't say that, did it?
No. But my father says it lacks the force of law.
You know how he is. He seeks the rational explanation.
He likes to put a good face on everything and hope for the best.
Sandro shook his head, chewing his biscotto.
So what can we do?
Nothing.
Sandro looked away, chewing, and Marco felt terrible for him.
It will be discredited. You're Italian, and that's all there is to it.
It's anti-Semitism.
Sandro fell silent, the word dropping between them with a weight of its own. Marco felt its gravity, even though he wasn't Jewish.
That's exactly right. If I hear anything new about it at work, I'll let you know.
Thanks.
Sandro sighed.
How's La Sapienza?
Wonderful. And challenging. I learn something new every day.
Marco shook his head.
And as for romance, we're at an impasse. Elisabetta still hasn't decided between us.
Sandro chewed his biscotto.
We can't push her. She's so busy, with a lot on her shoulders.
True. I feel sorry for her.
So do I.
Sandro looked over, finishing his biscotto.
I think about her all the time.
So do I.
Marco rolled his eyes.
It won't go away. Sometimes I wish it would.
I feel the same way. I don't concentrate as well as I need to at work.
I know what you mean. And when I'm riding at night, I peek in the window of the restaurant trying to catch a glimpse of her. It's pathetic.
Sandro smiled.
And you still date no one else? No other girl tempts you?
Marco smiled back.
Not a one. I live like a priest. I'm the second Father Terrizzi.
Sandro laughed.
Look at us, lovesick, mooning over the same woman.
Mah,
Marco said, frustrated.
I'd better get going.
Sandro rose, swinging his rucksack over his shoulder.
It was good to see you.
Me too.
Marco stood up, giving Sandro a hug goodbye. It struck him as no longer fun that they were competing for the same woman. And for the first time, Marco realized that no matter which of them Elisabetta chose, he would lose. For he loved Sandro too.
Chapter 30. Elisabetta. August 1938.
Papa, wake up!
Elisabetta set her father's coffee next to the couch, then kissed him on the cheek. She could smell that he needed a bath, and he had been wearing the same clothes for days, despite her protestations. He had become terribly thin, and his unshaven face had a yellowish tint, as he had been diagnosed